You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Thanks so much for joining us at the United States Institute of Peace today for the first in what will be a series of events we are going to host on conflict and cooperation in the Indo-Pacific region. Today, we are kicking off with a discussion of China-India dynamics, particularly in the last couple of years since the deadly clash in Galwan in the Himalayan mountains changed the trajectory of the relationship between Asia's two largest powers. We're also have a distinct opportunity to showcase some of the somewhat newly arrived additional talent that is filling out the incredible Asia team here at the United States Institute of Peace. I'm very happy to have a bunch of new members of our team joining us. You can follow along online. You can submit questions directly through the USIP web portal on your mobile device or on your computer. Our hashtag is IndoPacificUSIP. So please follow us online and join me in welcoming our panelists, who I will introduce before I start the program. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Good to see you all, new friends at USIP. So for our discussion today, we're joined by three distinguished scholars of Asia, starting with Andrew Scobell, who is now a distinguished fellow on the China program at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Andrew joins us from, more than a decade at the RAND Corporation. He is an extremely prolific analyst, writer, editor of things most of our audience will have read, largely on China's military power and China's foreign relations throughout the region. And Andrew was born and raised in Hong Kong, so he's well-versed in all the changes that are happening in the Asia-Pacific at a very personal level. To Andrew's left is Dr. Dan Markey. Dan joins us from CICE, a great source of talent for us in recent times, Carla as well. Dan is senior expert, senior advisor for South Asia for the center now. He came to us from CICE and from the Council on Foreign Relations. His most recent book is China's Western Horizon, which is an extremely interesting and in-depth look at China's relations with its neighbors to the west in Central Asia and South Asia. And to Dan's left is Carla Freeman. Carla also joins us from CICE. She previously ran the foreign relations, she previously ran the Foreign Policy Institute at CICE and has most recently published really interesting work on China's policy with regards to both oceans and space. And it's tremendous to have these new colleagues on our team here at USIP. I'm really thrilled they could join us for this discussion. And so we're gonna dive right in. The place I wanted to start our talk was at what was sort of, I think has been seen as a pivot point in Sino-Indian relations, which is the early 2020 clash high in the Himalaya Mountains, which claimed the lives of 20 Indian soldiers and at least four, but perhaps as many as several dozen Chinese. We don't yet know. The fact that the Chinese turned to force and combat and caused casualties for the first time in two generations up along the line of actual control really drove a shift in India's policy. They did not go back to a rapprochement. They started to shut down Chinese investment in India. They banned Chinese apps. They took a pretty firm response. We didn't see sort of this an effort to patch things over quickly. And the Chinese, while both sides have had talks and discussions and military talks, even as recently as the Olympics, they decided to feature a Galwan hero as one of the torchbearers leading India to join in the so-called diplomatic boycott of the games. So I thought Andrew might help us zoom in and just sort of discuss what is going on at that disputed border, what's the military situation look like, and then we'll have a discussion about how it features into both countries' strategic thinking.
Okay. Thanks, Vikram. You perfectly teed me up. The incident you talked about happened in June 2020, and what I dubbed the rumble in the Himalayas. And it sounds a little trite, but it was brutal hand-to-hand combat between Chinese and Indian troops. As you mentioned, at least 24 casualties, likely more deaths, I should say, killed, and many more injured. It was the most serious violence between China and India since the 1962 Sino-Indian War. It's unusual in terms of the size of the clash and the high body count, but it's not an isolated or out-of-the-blue episode. Clashes and confrontations periodically occur. Why? I think it really boils down to a long-standing, unresolved territorial dispute. The boundary between India and China was never properly surveyed and delineated. Historically, empires and kingdoms haven't tended to be very interested or very concerned about precisely fixing where one empire ends and where another begins. This is especially true in isolated and remote, desolate frontiers like the Himalayas. Indeed, the rulers of the British Raj and of the Qing Dynasty weren't at all really interested in demarcating boundaries. Very low priority. By contrast, contemporary nation states are much more concerned with territorial sovereignty and clearly defining and controlling borders. So why haven't the People's Republic of China, excuse me, and the Republic of India taken care of their unfinished border business? On the face of it, this failure is all the more surprising, given that China's been remarkably successful at resolving its land border disputes with many other countries. And so India stands as a glaring exception. I think the answer, in a nutshell, is that there's been an enduring climate of distrust and suspicion between Beijing and New Delhi, and that's really gotten in the way of multiple rounds of negotiations over the years that have come to nothing. That said, Beijing and New Delhi have been able to manage the tensions and de-escalate confrontations and clashes along their disputed borders. There have been some noteworthy accords and confidence-building measures. Just want to highlight one, that's no use of firearms. So this bloody border battle of 2020 in the Galwan Valley was waged without a single shot being fired. But can Sino-Indian border tensions continue to be managed? I think it's certainly possible, but I think it's dangerous to assume that this will continue. I think there are reasons for grave concern. Advances in technology and military capabilities on both sides, both conventional and strategic, both India and China have modernized their nuclear arsenals and improved the capabilities of their delivery systems. On the conventional side, we've seen an increase in the number and capabilities of forward deployed forces. So along this disputed frontier region. So I think that tees up in my mind what I've called a shift from what I've dubbed the Himalayan standoff, which is stable if chronic, to a more Mexican-style standoff that's much more acute and escalatory in nature. So that is a cause for concern. Now, that said, Beijing and New Delhi have been have worked hard over the years to cooperate where their mutual interests intersect, and that's included trade. You know, China is India has been India's largest trading partner for a good number of years now. That said, there's a whole laundry list of grievances, including the disposition of Pakistan, the status of Tibet, maritime issues, the Belt and Road Initiative, to name but a few. So these, at the end of the day, India and China are two rising powers that increasingly perceive each other as great power rivals locked in long-term competition. Thanks.
Yeah, that's it's really interesting. In a way, you wonder if this is extremely high altitude, extremely harsh environment. It's very difficult to sustain forces, and then maybe as each country's increased its capabilities, it's become just more possible to clash, right? Rather than they're not prevented because they're able to be up there. But the question then becomes sort of why. And Carl, I might turn to you next. Where does this one issue fit in the broader way in which India approaches China? And was this sort of, at some level, if China wants this good trading relationship with India, wants to have sort of this win-win cooperation that it always highlights, it seems like this kind of threw a bit of a hand grenade into that, right? And was it a misstep, or is it intended to show something, to shift something in the longer term? What are your thoughts on where this fits for the Chinese?
No, thanks for the great question, and it also, I think, segues really nicely from Andrew's comments. Chinese themselves are now characterizing the relationship, perhaps with reference to the altitude at which the clash is taking place, as a cold peace. This is very, very different from before, where there was an effort to emphasize cooperative aspects of the relationship. You know, the timing of the conflict in Galwan raised a lot of questions about whether China's use of violence in that conflict after so long was not a diversionary tactic. Because of course, the timing of the conflict in spring of 2020 coincided not only with COVID and the lockdown of major Chinese cities, but also with unrest in Hong Kong, which picked up after some quiescence in early spring by May. So there was that, and there was also a delayed National People's Congress from March to May, at which important legislation, national security legislation, the anti-sedition law aimed at Hong Kong, was also passed. So there was a sense that China domestically had a difficult agenda, and that perhaps the violence in the Himalayas would be used by the Chinese government to reinforce nationalist support. But in fact, as you noted the in your opening comments, the Chinese government has downplayed the number of casualties, which may, as you said, be number in the dozens, only releasing the number the information that four soldiers died in the conflict in February of 2021. So many, many months after the actual event. And in statements, although official statements certainly emphasize and describe the conflict, there was an effort to suggest that the conflict was caused by a lack of discipline on the Indian side. So rather than make this a major conflict between two powers, China downplayed all of that. That has changed more recently. It seems that China has now has pivoted after some months of trying to work with India to now using the crisis to stir up domestic nationalist sentiment against India. In October, released a video of the clash, and and hailed the four dead Chinese soldiers as martyrs. There were also images released of the Chinese soldiers raising a Chinese flag in Galwan. Those images have been recirculated more recently. And as you mentioned, a commander who was injured at Galwan was made an Olympic torchbearer. And more recently, there's now an emphasis, even in the Chinese media, on China's success in the 1962 border war, something that really had not been featured in Chinese discourse, and also an emphasis on China's moral conduct in that war. So, you know, what does all of this mean strategically? It certainly means that China-India relations are strained in a way they have not been in recent decades. Their border conflict may, in fact, now define the relationship. That's really different and important for a couple of reasons. One of the implications is that China is tightening its relationship with Pakistan, ever an all-weather partner, but now all-weather strategic cooperative partner. And if you look at the recent joint statement between China and Pakistan issued just a few days ago, following the meeting between Imran Khan and Xi Jinping, that highlights a stronger defense and sovereignty cooperation between the two countries. It's also notable that it's a very long statement. In point 27 of that statement, it mentions CPEC, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, in the context of Jammu and Kashmir, which makes a statement about Chinese opposition to action that complicates the territorial dispute, which I think is a shift by linking CPEC to the territorial dispute. And that's followed by a point about an agreement between Pakistan and China to discuss linking CPEC to Afghanistan, also significant in the context of India-Pakistan relations. Second, taking a point from an essay by a former Indian foreign minister that has been cited a lot, the clash has recentered the China-India relationship, as I said earlier, on the territorial dispute in a way that focuses on territorial sovereignty, rather than on, as Andrew was saying, on the lines drawn by colonial powers. And the latter focus allowed the two countries to sort of make standing up to the West a shared dimension of their relationship, one that facilitated cooperation at the global level. It also means the direction of the Sino-Indian border dispute. It really means that Xi Jinping has dug deep into a policy that he's led since he became China's leader in 2012-2013 of enforcing China's sovereignty claims all along China's long territorial land and maritime borders, against what I think China sees as an increasingly hostile regional environment. China has, of course, recently renamed mountains and other features in India-controlled Arunachal Pradesh, and has also built more military camps and air bases in the Himalayas, reinforcing its position, even as it initially suggested it would be willing to negotiate. And this salami slicing or silkworm nibbling strategy is all consistent with some new administrative tools that China's also rolled out, including a new land border law and a new Coast Guard law, which actually authorizes the use of weapons to stop illegal border crossings and threats to Chinese infrastructure along the borders, raising the prospect that firearms could actually be used up. Although for decades the two sides have refrained from using weapons against each other along their contested border.
Do you think that there's a sort of a more unity in China's approach to all territorial disputes? Is this an effort to have consistency, i.e. we will not bend on Taiwan, we will not bend in the South China Sea, we will not bend on the line of actual control? So maybe there's an openness to diplomacy, but it's on our terms.
China had Xi Jinping, one of the first meetings he held with his on foreign affairs was on periphery diplomacy. And periphery relations has been a major focus. I think you can see a reassessment by China of the threats that it faces in its periphery and an effort to consolidate its territorial stakes wherever they may be. So whether it's the Diaoyu Senkakus, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Xinjiang, Bhutan and other and the China-India border, China has been very clear that it won't yield 1 inch of territory.
And I think that, just to add a point, I think that the reason that maybe there's the consistency, growing consistency, is because it's seen as from Beijing as being directly related to domestic internal stability,
right,
whether it's in Tibet or Xinjiang, mm-hmm, or elsewhere. So makes it all the more important, this peripheral.
Yeah, you know, one of the fascinating things about India-China relations is that for so long, despite the Tibet dispute and despite India hosting the Dalai Lama, you know, both countries focused on their cooperative aspects of the relationship for so long.
Yeah.
All the way to, you know, following another border dispute, they had this, you know, summit in Wuhan, and they had the Wuhan spirit, you know, pre-COVID. So, so Dan, for India, this is a pretty big pivot away from what seems to have been a leader level and consistent determination to have as constructive a relationship as possible with Beijing.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was sort of seems like it was the thing that pushed them over into a different approach. So how does it look from India's perspective now, in your view, and what are the implications for what India, you know, how India will behave in terms of its regional relationship and its relationship with China in the next, you know, several years?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, a pivot, you've identified this as a pivot point from, say, 2020 to the present. Sea change is described that way. Certainly a rude awakening for India about the nature of its relationship with China. And if I'm not mistaken, talk about leader-level meetings, whereas in, you know, 2018, definitely an effort to cultivate a Modi-Xi relationship of some sort, you know, to the extent that these things are ever possible. Now, my understanding is that they haven't spoken in 2 years. Stunning, right?
Yeah.
Other reversals. I mean, I remember prior to 2020, individuals within, close to the Modi in the Prime Minister's office near that, discussing how the Prime Minister was committed to improving the relationship with China. Not so much because there was certainly no ideological overlap or a meeting of the minds on so many different things, but out of a sheer necessity and a recognition of the economic drivers of India's growth and the extent to which India is in many ways, if not dependent upon China, will benefit from that relationship economically. I remember, again, say 5 years ago, 6 years ago, working on and asking questions about doing research on the potential for an India-China clash of some sort, and visiting in Delhi and talking to assorted experts and so on, and really having a difficult time convincing them that this was something they needed to worry about. And so this shift really is a marker. And I think that it will be, in hindsight, assuming nothing even more dramatic happens in the near term, this period will be seen in a way as a kind of a next chapter. So if India and its view of the world, its relationship with major powers in the world, shifted dramatically after the Cold War, a need to, you know, find an opening to the West and reform its economics and opens to the US and Europe and so on, and was only sort of delayed or sidetracked in a sense by the 1998 nuclear tests, and then the subsequent, say, post-Cold War and post-9/11 era of warming to the United States, this offered an opportunity for India that persisted till 2020 to basically be friends with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I think this will be seen as sort of a golden period in India's, you might call it, multi-vector approach to foreign policy, but basically being courted on all sides. So whether it was the United States or the Russians or the Europeans or even the Chinese, who, when Modi came into office, perceived him as a welcome shift and as an opportunity to build closer ties with India, because they had known him as chief minister, he had visited China on numerous occasions, they saw real opportunities there. And so to see that, and then 2020 hits, to see this change, one Chinese expert has described this recently to me as a period of finding a new equilibrium now in the India-China relationship. And I think that's right. But because the India-China relationship has been so thrown by the events of 2020, India is also, I think, going to be forced to find new equilibriums in a bunch of the other relationships that it was really enjoying over the past nearly 20 years. So that would include with Russia. It's certainly fostering and building ties with a number of other states, you know, through the Quad and so on. And then not least the United States, where I think it's having a very direct implication for India's view of the world. So this is an unwelcome change from India's perspective. This is not something it sought or wanted, but it is being forced, as I think we've already discussed, to really turn a page in an important way.
You guys have all hit on like seven issues that we could go into, but stepping out to the region, I actually want to really quickly touch on something you said in terms of how it's going to impact India with other relationships. So Carla mentioned Imran Khan and she having their meeting. Putin and Xi also had a meeting and released a voluminous, almost 6,000 word statement that does seem to include some shifts. Certainly was very forceful about not supporting NATO expansion, where more so than I remember, and things like that. But on, in terms of the implications for India, which has long relied on Russia as its strategic partner, certainly all of its major defense systems are of Russian origin in terms of, you know, strategic systems, missiles, submarines, etc. What does it mean that this? What is the sort of steady growth in the Putin-Xi alignment mean for India? But before that, Andrew or Carla, either of you jump in. What do you view as the changes in that Russia-China relationship? Is this just sort of more of the same, or is there something different going on?
I think it's relationship between Moscow and Beijing, I think has strengthened, but I don't think it's qualitatively changed. That said, there's certainly more cooperation strategically and military-wise. But I think in terms of taking it to the next level, which would essentially be a full-blown alliance in my view, because then I don't think they're going to go there, barring some remarkable shift, dramatic shift. In their relationship, say with the U.S., because they've tried that alliance before, it didn't turn out so well. So I think they're reluctant to go that way. So they're friends with benefits and without commitments.
Right.
So that statement you mentioned, the long statement, full of positive, enthusiastic language, but short of a ironclad commitment to support. From the Chinese side, to support the Russians, but how it'll spill out onto and into South Asia, that's a really really interesting question. But one thing that struck me, Dan, about what you said was the Galwan in 2020 constituted a rude awakening for China, and I think that really is to me brings up an. It seems like a really strong parallel with the 62 war, because I think that, from the research I've done anyway, that was a rude awakening for India. So in that context, the disposition of a longtime friend in Moscow is a really interesting, a really interesting question.
So China, India. So Carla, dig a little bit more on the China-Pakistan piece of this as well. Where does Pakistan fit into what China is thinking, and how much is that connected to Chinese concerns about India, and how much is that just about its economic, plans under BRI and access to the sea from the West? How does that factor? And then Dan, react on both Russia and the Pakistan fronts.
I mean, the China-Pakistan relationship predates BRI by many decades and has had
higher than the mountains,
right? Higher than the mountains, and is very much connected to India's India-Pakistan tensions and concerns. But the China had been very, very careful to try to keep the BRI and its relation, its economic relationship and CPEC below the strategic level, and really focus on economic development and CPEC as a way of strengthening cross-border ties and improving stability between China and Pakistan across the border, opening up new opportunities for economic development in China's impoverished West, and so on. But I think I do think it's worth paying attention to the implications of this latest statement, whether it actually changes how China is looking at CPEC or how it will present CPEC. India, of course, has always seen CPEC as a strategic move, a slice through contested territory down the Karakoram Highway. So I think that's something to watch very carefully.
Yeah, pre-statement, a lot of reports about the trouble. I mean, China's faced attacks. It's had its people killed that are working on CPEC projects by terrorists inside Pakistan, and there was, some question. But the statement, that meeting, was a doubling down. They were not, we're not backing off. We're committed to CPEC was the message out of that last meeting. So, Dan, what are the implications for India of both the China-Pakistan and the China-Russia relationship?
Yeah, so the China-Russia relationship, it puts India in a real bind, where New Delhi doesn't want to be in a position where its principal supplier of its highest end, in some cases by a mile, equipment, nuclear submarines, various missile systems, including defense systems that they're S-400. You're looking to Russia as your supplier, and now Russia is increasingly in bed with your principal competitor and threat. The kind of vulnerabilities that this creates for India, particularly, say, at a moment where, China will be inclined to be helpful to Russia in a Ukraine scenario. India, of course, has to sit silently on Ukraine, watch Russia do whatever. It can't make a peep. And yet, China could see this as an opportunity to push India around, because, of course, Russia isn't going to do anything that jeopardizes its relationship with China in the midst of a Ukraine scenario. So India comes out remarkably, much worse. As I was trying to say before, it used to be just a matter of a few short years ago, India could have it all. It could have swimming, relations. Right. It could be in the BRICS and in the Quad. It could, fly to Moscow and be feted, and Beijing as well, and Washington. And this is crumbling. And I would have to think that the sense of vulnerability that this creates is acute. Shifting over to the Pakistan piece, and one of the things that's so interesting about how this has evolved is that in many ways, the China-Pakistan relationship, as Carla rightly pointed out, it's the CPEC portion of it and its new intensity was not intended, at least it didn't seem, by Beijing to result in a deterioration in Beijing's relationship with New Delhi. To the contrary, Chinese diplomats were attempting to cultivate better ties with India at the same time, right, and they failed. And so where that points to me is the extent to which, say, bigger powers like China get sucked into regional conflicts where they didn't really intend to go. And I think it's getting worse. And the one thing that we have to be sort of, in a sense, grateful for is the extent to which India-Pakistan hot conflict along their border hasn't brought in the Chinese, neither has India-China hot conflict along their border brought in the Pakistanis. But it almost feels like that's the next shoe to drop.
I mean, that's an interesting question. Would China, in a moment of India-Pakistan crisis, rather than seeing its role as let's try to simmer things down, we don't want things to get out of hand, would it potentially say, well, let's make a move in Arunachal Pradesh because the Indians are tied down on that side, or vice versa? Dan, would Pakistan do the same thing at some point to India? It certainly, I would think, in both would probably perceive it as in their interest to have India at least having to worry about that.
Yeah.
What do you think, Andrew? Do you think that would be a
Well, I think no country right now, certainly not China, has an interest in a war. And hence the policy is, you know, whether it's salami slicing or nibbling or that it's you know, to keep things below the threshold of war. And to the extent that, you know, we're talking about Galwan and it's, you know, been this wake-up call for New Delhi, you know, China's efforts have been not very, you know, have the success has changed, because you know, over time, I think for, you know, India was surprised, you know, would go along the border patrols would find things that you know, that China had changed the facts on the ground and done so, you know, quote successfully below the radar. But of course with Galwan that's changed. So even though that approach has been less than successful in recent years, China doesn't want to switch to conflict. Certainly not for the for the next 12 months or so. You know, Xi Jinping wants a successful 20th Party Congress this fall, and I think in the greater scheme of things, other areas, other territorial, so-called territorial disputes, have a higher priority than the Himalayas, and in particular, of course, Taiwan. So I think Xi Jinping will be reluctant to sort of be forced to shift focus to South Asia.
Harley, you agree with that?
I do agree with that. I think we see, and I've forgotten who initiated it, but there is an effort to use the Russia-China-India trilateral mechanism to have talks. Maybe China, I'm not sure if China initiated the last meeting or not, but to have talks through that mechanism. And you know, at the same time, you know, China has certainly been not taken any steps to hinder India's participation, very important participation in the Asian Investment Infrastructure Investment Bank. India has continued to take loans throughout the entire crisis, and in fact, maybe the largest recipient of AIIB loans. The New Development Bank, the BRICS Bank, continues to grow. India is a critical part of that, expanding now to, I think, include Egypt. So there's work among the partners in that area. And so there are areas where China is still seeking to engage India. These are, of course, arenas in which China is a key player, a leading player. SCO would be another example where China has been trying to engage India as a partner through various projects. But again, where it is in a position of leadership, and this is difficult for India politically. But so far, at least where AIIB and some of these other arenas are concerned, India has not pulled back and has continued to participate.
Which seems to suggest certain pragmatism on the Indians' part, not wanting to be iced out of all these multilateral fora that China has been creating and building in the region. Although it's shied away from the trade ones, RCEP in particular.
That's right. Yeah.
And what do you think about just that Pakistan dynamic there, and Pakistan hoping that China sort of backing it up or complicating things for India? Are they relying on that?
I think that In 2019, as far as I understand, when India and Pakistan were going back and forth, and things looked like they might, at least from Washington, they looked like they might spiral out of control. One of the concerns that the United States had, you asked if China would play a restraining role. You know, China's playing a mixed role. In fact, the United States, I think it would be fair to say, is playing a mixed role. To the extent that the United States, to take us first, we have an interest in making sure that India doesn't come out the worse from a scuffle with Pakistan. We want to support them. We also recognize that generally they've been a victim of terrorism, Pakistan-based terrorism, and they ought not to suffer the consequences of that, and they ought to have the capacity to defend themselves from that kind of an attack. From the Chinese perspective, they see Pakistan as a friend and and legitimately concerned about its own defense and its capacity to maintain a deterrent against India. And so that has been, that's the initial message. U.S. support to India, legitimate grievance against Pakistan. Chinese support to Pakistan, legitimate concern about India going too far. And in 2019, India went pretty far. Direct strikes on Pakistani territory for the first time in decades. This initial move, but then is, I think correctly, my colleagues have pointed out, neither the United States nor China wants to see India and Pakistan actually go to war.
Right.
So there's this push so far, but not so far as to get into a point that you actually find yourselves in a true war, and least of all, a nuclear war, which is possible. Playing that in the midst of a crisis, playing that balancing game of we'll push this far, we'll support this much, but we think we know enough not to support so much that they would take that and push and escalate, this is a tricky business.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that not only do we have a trouble with that, but I think the Chinese have trouble calibrating. And both the Indians and Pakistanis themselves, you know, I don't think they want to go to war either, but they are playing the same game. And put all these complexities together, and it's a recipe for more trouble.
So China and has been building its network of regional structures and, trying to institutionalize its relationships bilaterally and multilaterally throughout the region. Recently, we've seen a lot of new developments and a lot of new activity with India and largely Western democracies. So in particular, the Quad.
Right.
The Chinese have been clear that they don't love the Quad and clear that they really hate the AUKUS, which doesn't include India, but is another new Western-oriented security structure, which is the Australia, UK-US agreement on nuclear submarines and other sophisticated capabilities. India seems to welcome that. Where do you see, start with Dan, what is India's sort of game plan here when it comes to broadening out how it's engaging with more like-minded countries and how that helps it, stand up to China to the degree that's what it's seeking to do? And then for Andrew and Carla, how concerned is Beijing about these other mechanisms? Or does Beijing sort of feel like it has the momentum and the weight of history behind it and will be the one to set the terms?
I think the history of the Quad, such as it is, is kind of a good way to chart the progress of Indian attitudes about China and about its relations with other powers in the region. And you can see that, the Quad, having been born all the way back in, 2003, 2004, I guess, at the time, just a kind of an ad hoc organization in response to international humanitarian crisis, but over time, an attempt, certainly spearheaded at the outset by the United States, to turn it into something more. And a clear reluctance for many, many years on the Indian part to accept that. Why? Because they were trying to play this balancing game. And people in India, Shiv Shankar Menon among them, have pointed out that for a very long time, India's goal, strategically, has been in the triangular relationship between India, the United States, and China, to be closer to both the United States and China than either of them were to one another.
Right.
Okay, that's been the core feature of India's approach. But over time, with the deterioration in relations with China and the warming of relations between India and the United States, that triangle has gotten out of whack. and that's what India is trying to deal with now. Now, to be clear, the Quad is still, on paper and in words, intended not to be a security relationship, and I think India is comfortable with that. So where does that leave us? I think the Quad is good, a number of these other organizations, good for the softer stuff. And then I think India will be looking to resolve what I described as its kind of a conundrum with respect to Russia as a military supplier, looking to other bilateral relationships to fill in the gaps, whether it's with the United States or with France or with Israel. These are going to be, I think, priority suppliers looking into the future. with Russia potentially fading, particularly if the Russia-China relationship tightens.
Yeah, absolutely. How seriously does the China side, Carla, you first, how seriously does China take these innovations? How much are they worried about the Quad, or do they see it as, a poor imitation of what China's been doing?
Yeah, I mean, the Chinese initially dismissed the Quad as, I think maybe it was Wang Yi who called it seafoam. I think they take it a lot more seriously and are really concerned about India's deepening commitment to this partnership and some of the new partnerships that are emerging out of it, like India's growing ties. They've been growing for a while, but strengthening with Japan. For example, the two countries are engaged in economic development projects in India, but also in Myanmar and in other places, and are doing some naval drills and that kind of thing together. So I think China's very concerned about that. China, though, has sort of looked at the Quad and it's still its focus on public goods and responded in a way in turn by strengthening its, trying to increase its own profile in other regional organizations. CPTPP stands out for me and China's application to the CPTPP is a way of getting in, forming new partnerships with countries, particularly since the United States isn't part of that important economic organization or agreement.
As you touched on a very interesting point, which is that in terms of economic statecraft in the region, it's been sort of an open field for the Chinese, at least on trade agreements of varying degrees of utility and value. But, the U.S. has been largely absent. Europe, to a large degree, has also been absent. There's been some bilateral things. India and the UK are trying to negotiate a trade deal, for example, but for the most part, not. So just, Andrew, how would you see, touch on two things, with the Quad and then just overall the sort of economic order that's shaping up in the region and whether that plays more to China or more to India and the West?
Yeah, on the economic side of things, honest answers, I'm not sure. I guess on that front, it depends how effectively the U.S. and Europe are good at ramping up their initiatives in the region, because they've, for better or for worse, they've kind of conceded ground the region to China as being the. Being the dominant economic engine for the region. On the as to the Quad and other structures, I think the irony is that as China's grown stronger and more, and its security position has become stronger, its leaders have continued to be insecure and in some ways become more insecure. So viewing things like the Quad as threatening, and in two ways, one in terms of hard power, they're concerned about other countries under the leadership of the U.S. sort of ganging up and containing China, but they're also concerned about the soft power dimension. They see, it's hard for us in the U.S. and other democracies are worried about Chinese influence operations. Well, I think the funny thing is the Chinese assume that's what we're doing to them.
Right.
And so the Quad is an alliance, from a Chinese perspective, seen as an alliance of democracies. And something, so they're concerned about that dimension. Of course, who's not in favor of democracy? Even the Chinese Communist Party is in favor of democracy, but it's democracy with Chinese characteristics,
yes.
Right? It's a special kind of democracy. So all these efforts, whether it's the Quad or other multilateral efforts by the U.S. and allies and partners and when they include major countries in the region like India, I think this is concerning to China, because because also from a Chinese perspective, why are they having so many problems now with so many countries? Right. Why are relations so bad with so many countries? You know, with a few notable exceptions, right? Pakistan and Russia stand out here. But the Chinese are convinced the answer to that question is it's because the U.S. is orchestrating things behind the scenes. I think there's no willingness to entertain the idea maybe this is happening because of what China's doing.
Right. Yeah, that is really interesting. And you bring me to the last area I'd like to touch on before I do want to turn to audience questions. We have had a bunch coming in, and we have 25 or so minutes left. So multilateral. Everyone's touched on it a little bit. But when it comes to India and China, for quite a long time, they kind of, as Dan referenced, could be in the anti-colonial, anti-imperialist camp, be on the side of the G77, developing world, global south, you know, and they would and they would probably more often than not, you know, we might more often than not find them on the same side, and us wishing that India would be on the side of the U.S. or the West in multilateral fora. And at this point, I think that extends to rule setting, you know, and very technical things like the ITU. It extends to, you know, General Assembly resolutions. But so China and India are no longer neatly aligned in multilateral fora. But India and the United States are also not neatly aligned. And there does seem to be a sense, I think, widely held that China is trying to establish some dominance in multilateral settings across the board. We just saw the EU announce that they're going to monitor Chinese actions in multilateral settings and try to be ready to push back. I think the United States, when it comes to standard settings, wants to do something similar. So two questions. You know, how successful is China going to be at this? How central is this sort of resetting, adjusting, tweaking of the global order to Xi's vision? And where will India be? Will India end up deciding to strategically throw in with Europe, Japan, the United States, who all won't always agree, but will sort of be more in the same place?
Well, let me
first.
I mean, China has a policy of approaching global governance on what it calls two legs. I mean, one is by developing its own institutions that can advance its interests and reflect its values and its its characteristics, if you will. And the other is by modifying existing rules and norms to align with China's interests and also those of the developing world, highlighting that it is speaking for a developing country. So this is a really interesting question, and it is going to be a challenge because China and India have aligned on so many of so many issues in multilateral forum. So where is India going to find itself, especially as China uses its economic clout to expand its voice, uses its just sheer number of personnel to take important positions in the United Nations, and in many ways gets ahead of even the West in drafting laws on everything from AI to data sovereignty that it then can put forward and put into multilateral fora. So it's becoming a leader in global governance. How successful is it? It's making some inroads. It is effectively setting some agendas. I don't think it's taking over the United Nations. I think we have to look at that more carefully. There's some good scholars who are working on this to assess this objectively. But it is having an impact, and you start to see reflected in UN statements phrases in other language that are promoted by China, by Xi Jinping himself, shared future for all mankind, that sort of thing, which advance an ambiguous vision, but certainly something that China can use to set a distant guidepost and then build toward through its work in these global fora.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan.
If I could pick up on the India angle, it would be, if you're India, as you're growing, you want to make sure that whatever doors were open to China ahead of you remain open after China has gone through them.
Right.
And with respect to the multilateral context, things like a nuclear status, nuclear suppliers group, and so on, these are areas where China is eager to jump through the door and then slam it behind and
right.
leave India out in the cold. And I think that, so strategically, India has to position itself and will be sort of opportunistic, and I think sees the United States and others as potential partners in making sure that China doesn't close the door behind it. Or maybe India can just wedge its way through and close the door behind it, keep Pakistan out. But that's a big part of the answer. The other part of the answer is that India's identity, and this is what you're getting at, its identity, in a sense, will help to determine its aims on the world stage. And its identity is mixed. It is not a Western liberal democracy like Western Europe or the United States. It has a different historical and cultural ideological background to it, and it will bring that to the table as it approaches these organizations. And Vikram, as you pointed out, you know, the United Nations hasn't been a place where the United States and India have aligned on many votes in the General Assembly. To the contrary, we're finding ourselves more often than not at odds. And so as the, you know, as American policymakers look at India as a partner on the world stage in multilateral organizations, the answer to what India sees as its aims will be critically important to us. And if India defines itself more in, say, civilizational terms, then the answer will continue to be very mixed. Democracy or not, form of government will only define aspects of how India relates. But if India sees itself, again, you know, as China does in civilizational terms often, then it will often often disagree with the United States as agree. And I think that's going to be maybe a way to, at least for the United States, to rethink a bit. I think over the past 20 years or so, we've seen India as a natural follower in the succession of liberal democratic order and defender of it into the future. And I think we have to at least keep open to the prospect that that's not quite the best way to see India.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That we could have a whole discussion just on that. I do want to turn to our audience. Once again, if you're joining us online, you can submit a question on usip.org right there in right below where you're watching the video. And you can also use the hashtag Indo-Pacific USIP if you want to comment or pass up a question that way. We have folks monitoring, and they'll get them to us here on the screen so we can read them out. So there's sort of a theme in some of the early questions which relates to Kashmir. So I'm gonna bundle a couple together, and just to set the table with so China has done a couple of things that sort of moved it towards taking a position on the Kashmir dispute more so in recent years than previously. One is, of course, related to CPEC, where, from the Indian standpoint, the Chinese have essentially ratified the Pakistani position on one disputed piece of territory in Kashmir because they're having a project run through it. The second is the Chinese came out vocally in opposition to the revocation of Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which gave Kashmir autonomy. The Indians, of course, said this just affects Indian-controlled Kashmir, so it's completely a domestic issue. And it was one of those times when you sort of saw the Chinese in a funny mirror because, wait a minute, they're saying, no, this is of concern to us. And so one of the questions from the audience is, will, and I would say is, China becoming more actively involved in the Kashmir dispute by virtue of CPEC and where it is sort of siding with Pakistan? And I would twin that to another border question, which is how does the historic levels of unrest that India's had in its own border regions, especially in the Northeast, how does that play into China's thinking and into sort of the overall dynamics of settling border disputes? So I open that up to anybody.
Please.
Let me just pick up on a piece of that, and then others can maybe fill in on how China sees its involvement in Kashmir. But I would say that, you know, you mentioned the Article 370 revocation, shifting Indian policies in Kashmir. India's management of its northeast in terms of administratively and in terms of governance, its response to local grievances and so on. Frankly, I would say all of these things have, in a way, exposed potential vulnerabilities of India to whether it's Pakistan or to China. I think they're intended, these policies are intended by the central government in India to actually clamp down and to impose greater centralized authority over these regions where there has been unrest. Unfortunately, I think the way that they've been managed leads to, I think, lingering and long-lasting underlying grievances that will spill over into violence for years, perhaps generations to come. And when you are India and your borders are messy, that creates all kinds of opportunities for others to play games in them. Mm-hmm. India's experienced that, certainly with the Pakistanis have done that, both in these parts of India and then also in and elsewhere. China has done that in the Northeast historically, funding Maoist organizations and so on. So I think that's, if you're India, that's a worry that's going to continue to be worse. Whether China will seek to capitalize more and more, I mean, that's more on China's side than it is. But if I'm Indian, I'm nervous about that.
And Carla, Andrew, how does China look at whether it is or isn't taking a role in the Kashmir dispute based on what we see and it voicing a role a couple of times in recent years?
I think it's going to be reluctant to step much further out from where it's been, and so things that we've talked about have not been where it's arguably taken a position, but on Kashmir it hasn't really explicitly stepped into the limelight. It's done things that indicate that it's it doesn't, it's willing to challenge India. So, the Belt and Road Initiative, India is one of the most prominent, significant countries that's opted out of it. And excuse me, a big reason is because of the central role of Pakistan in the CPEC. So I don't see India. I don't see China going more. I don't think they're intentionally trying to antagonize India, but of course that's happening anyway.
Yeah, I think China would like to strengthen Pakistan's position without antagonizing India, but it has in fact antagonized India through CPEC. And as Andrew was saying, China is the only member of the SCO. India is the only member of the SCO that isn't part of the BRI. And it stands very much outside of that grouping. It's going to be interesting to see whether it creates challenges for the SCO. China tried to support integration of Pakistan and bringing them and India into the SCO, I think, as one way to kind of send the message that its interests in Kashmir, in CPEC, are really economic, but that's not a message that India is hearing.
Yeah, no, that's it is really interesting in a way, I think, from the Chinese perspective. So South Asia is sort of one of the least economically integrated regions, yes, on Earth. And from the Chinese perspective, that's got to look like a big opportunity, all these places that they can pick up the slack, as it were. And for the Indians, that becomes sort of an imperative to figure out ways to better integrate. Which brings me to tie into a question on how the neighbors respond. So the questioners mentioned a few countries, but I would say Bangladesh, Nepal, even Sri Lanka, which isn't a joint neighbor, but and then Myanmar, Bhutan. How do they view Sino-Indian tension throughout the region? Obviously, all of these countries have important relations with both China and India. So what's the sort of effect of Sino-Indian tensions in the region? Dan, jump in.
Yeah,
first.
I think it's one of those areas where it's evolving actually, and in some ways relatively rapidly, and it's fascinating. If we were to say historically, say going back over decades, one of the principal concerns of all of the so-called smaller states of South Asia and India's nearby neighbors was to avoid being dominated by the regional hegemon, that being India.
Right.
And so the principal concern for a lot of them, whether it's Bangladesh or Sri Lanka, was often how to get out from under the vice grip or the thumb of the overbearing New Delhi. So China has provided, over the past couple of decades, an opportunity, particularly leading with the economic foot,
yep.
an opportunity to escape from some of that dependency on India that was so a part of these societies. But I say it's evolving because the Chinese involvement has led, in some cases, we look at Sri Lanka at the moment, to an Indian response. And in some ways, that Indian response has been eager to outdo the Chinese or to find opportunities to now displace the Chinese from what they had found to be a more dominant, certainly economic and increasingly also political influence. And so it's a more open and fluid contest for outside influence than, you know, than we've seen in basically modern independent history of the region. And that becomes quite fascinating. You know, one of the things that I'd like to do more of is, and see more of, would be surveys and more detailed studies of attitudes in the region among these smaller countries about both India and China,
mm-hmm.
which I think is an important way for us to get a better window into how they're perceiving this competition. Certainly they're opportunistic in trying to take advantage of both relations when possible, but where's their skepticism, where there's wariness, and where there's a kind of an ideological or other compatibility would be something that we'll want to watch more closely.
I think that I've done a little bit of research on this, and it does seem that smaller countries really have welcomed China's engagement, economic engagement in the region, which, you know, as you said, Vikram, the integration of South Asia has been really constrained, partly because of the India-Pakistan conflict and tensions. So to have China come in as a new source with a vision for integration is very exciting for countries smaller countries in the region who look to Chinese investment to sort of break that the stranglehold that the regional hegemon India had on that integration. But now they are also trying to take advantage of the India-China strategic competition, but are also worried about getting caught up in a global strategic competition. So you do see India pushing back. You do see India starting to bring some concrete projects to the table, starting to partner again with Japan and with other countries in the region to bring to address this need for and desire for regional connectivity to sort of challenge China there. But at the same time, I think these smaller countries in the region are also getting increasingly sophisticated and concerned about getting locked into some kind of broader geostrategic competition that ultimately doesn't serve their long-term interests. They want the benefit of being able to use their role as desirable partners to leverage as much as they can without getting caught up in some bigger drama that they have little influence over.
Do you guys, any of you, but think that China will continue sort of BRI is sort of, there's a little bit of BRI for everybody, right? And so in this region, you know, Nepal, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, they're all, so is that, do you think China will continue that? Or do you think China's going to sort of refine BRI over time and sort of maybe cut back in the areas that have been the most troublesome? Or, you know, what does that look like?
I think one question I had when BRI hit some bumps, you know, there were some problems, was, you know, is there a feedback loop? Is China
right.
sort of learning and adjusting? And I think the answer is yes, but the question is how far they've
right.
gone on that. I think the larger question, whether it's, you know, China's role in an influence in multilateral organizations or BRI or its involvement in South Asia, is a question of, you know, how China's economy is going to proceed. And we tend to assume a straight line that it's going to continue to grow, maybe albeit at a lesser rate of growth. But I'm not sure we should just assume, take that for granted.
Right.
And, you know, China's economy is going through some turmoil right now, and certainly it's doing better than many other countries. But I think there are other domestic challenges that China's going to confront in the coming years, and that may influence the degree to which they're able to focus, sustain things like BRI, and engage as actively as they have been doing in the future. So that's on the soft power front, I think, in terms of its influence in specific countries and in multilateral fora, I think it's tied to China's hard power. So if China's economy continues to grow and be an engine of growth and be an opportunity for so many countries, then I think its soft power is likely to be sustained. But if its economy tanks or goes into crisis, or there's a political crisis that affects that, then I think that will adversely affect China's soft power.
Yeah, absolutely. A question from the audience is, what can the U.S. do? So if you're advising the American administration, the U.S. administration, what can we do to respond to closer China-Russia collaboration in the region? And I might just add, what could the United States, working with India, do to respond? The Indians, of course, don't necessarily want to have that response. But are there things beyond what we've seen, the Quad and other things, that could, and do we really need to worry about more concrete China-Russia collaboration in the region? I mean, certainly Russian naval engagement could be stepped up in the ensuing years. They could collaborate militarily in the region. Russia is also a Pacific power, after all.
I think there's a broader question about China-Russia collaboration. Say, forget about Indo-Pacific per se, but globally. Mm-hmm. I think Andrew made the point, the next step would be a full-on alliance. We're unlikely to see that. So how much of an effort could the United States make to drive a wedge into that? I think most of what I've seen suggests that any such effort would actually be likely to backfire. The alternative, and the logic being that basically we can't force them apart, but because a big part of the reason that they've come together is their mutual concerns about us. It's not their attraction between Moscow and Beijing. It's the repulsion from us. Now, in this era of looming potential war in Ukraine, it's hard to see that we're going to find a means to cozy up to Russia, but only with some greater attraction to some alternative power than China, will Russia, I think, be weaned away from China. Bottom line, Russia doesn't have many options right now. And so it's not a matter of, say, coercion or pushing or pressure, but a matter of finding alternative attractions that would find ways to pull them further apart and at the moment, it certainly doesn't look like that.
And to build on what Dan was saying, I think from China's perspective, they don't have a lot of options either. I mean, sure, there are lots of countries that want to be friends with China, but not countries with clout, the kind of clout that Russia has, a nuclear arsenal, a Perm 5 seat. So from China's perspective, Russia's important too. They need each other. And in a report that I lead author, or one of the, one was one of the lead authors on last year, the conclusion of a study looking at China and Russia cooperation is sad to say, disappointingly for probably many of our readers, was there's probably not much the U.S. can do to drive a wedge between Moscow and Beijing.
What I think we can do, though, is we can be active in multilateral fora where mm-hmm. those two voices are very closely aligned, and make sure that we do our work there to continue to push for rules of the road that that reflect our interests and values. So I think that's one space where those two partners where we can actually push against what their joint objectives are, and these have important implications for the long term, whether we're talking about space, AI, et cetera. Very important.
Yeah, absolutely. And we hardly got into the tech agenda and sort of the future of military conflict. We've basically come to the end of our allotted time. I want to give each of you a chance to just reflect on one final question. That is, like, so you know, 2022 is a big year. As you mentioned, Xi Jinping is looking to get through a party congress and have a sort of probably establish himself as a longer term ruler than others in the past. Are there any things we should expect between China and India? You know, any sort of major risks or opportunities for any kind of a reset between the two, any kind of a stabilizing of their relations that we should be on the lookout for over this year? And I say this as our timing is such that Secretary of State Blinken is out in the region right now. He's about to have a Quad foreign ministers meeting. He's about to go to Fiji and probably announce some more details of America's strategy in the region, which clearly always hinges on India. It is the Indo-Pacific now, after all. But do you expect anything in 2022, or do you think we're going to see both sides sort of trying to keep things quiet and work more in 2023 and beyond? Andrew,
I think India and China will both be quite happy to maintain some kind of equilibrium, uneasy stability. I think the bigger issue is what unforeseen circumstance might happen, and one that just leaps to mind is everybody dies, right? At some point, it's just a question of when. But I think that, the Dalai Lama is a key figure, and he's getting old, and not that he's going to die in 2022, but I think in the next few years that's likely, and that could influence situation in Tibet. That could influence China-India relations in either a positive or a negative way.
Probably negative, given where we think succession is going to go. Dan?
Almost impossible to see how that ends up being a easily managed scenario, but I think you're absolutely right to put your finger on it as one of critical and potentially near-term concern. I mean, we've not really said the word COVID.
Yep.
There are so many features of the international economic order right now that are pretty much up in the air.
Yeah.
And so many aspects of the nature of the China-India relationship that relate very directly to that. And COVID is one piece of it, but so many others that, our problems with supply chains and so on are revealing the nature of the international economic order and the potential for at least aspects of it to be remade. We talk about decoupling. India's relationship with China right now, I mean, the depths of their trading relationship, it's vital to India. But that vitality may wane if this economic order shifts. This is not going to happen over the next year, so I'm afraid it's not the answer to that question, but I think things that happen over the next year may set in motion patterns that will then shift the nature of their relationship that could, for a longer period of time, with the economic foundation really being a driver.
Well, I think after those comments, I'll end on more of a whimper than a bang, because I think that the two sides will try to keep things fairly stable in the coming year for their own political reasons. But I think it is important to recognize that is the world's longest border. There's a lot that can happen along it, and we haven't touched on water issues either. China and India have managed to their water tensions pretty effectively, but in the midst of all of this, China's announced construction of a new dam up at the in the heights of the Brahmaputra, so that could end up becoming another flashpoint.
That is one that I think we definitely need to keep watching. I want to thank everyone in the audience for joining us. I want to thank my fellow USIP teammates for taking the time out to have this great in-depth conversation.
We will continue to do these. It'll be hashtag Indo-Pacific USIP. There'll be more in this series on probably a bunch of the issues we discussed today. And hope you all have a great day, and thanks so much for joining us at USIP.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.